Good evening. Tonight, I begin with a conversation with Anatole Lieven about the U.S. as the indispensable nation. This is a remark made by the late Madeleine Albright, and the president, in his Oval Office address, repeated it, bolstering his case that the Congress cooperate and deliver more monies for Ukraine, for Taiwan, and especially for the Middle East, for the crisis in Israel at the Gaza border. The indispensable nation is ironic, of course, because it depends on who's asking. Right now, the indispensable nation is at odds with two powers of Eurasia, Russia and China. Indispensable nation is not much talked about in South America and Central America, except in terms of complaints, drug running, and migration. In Africa, I'm unaware that the indispensable nation is a force, especially in the fall of the Francafrique into the hands of either juntas or momentarily to be replaced by jihadists. The indispensable nation does have purchase in East Asia, good friends with Japan, Philippines, and Australia. Indispensable, though, may be a term from the 20th century. I then turned to a conversation with Carolyn Rose of New Lines Institute about the fragmented Syria at odds with everyone, all against all. At the same time, the Assad regime is linked closely with the Tehran regime, and Syria must be regarded as a threat not only to Israel but also to the United States. The Shia militia there or nearabouts have launched attacks, drone attacks, against U.S. deployment in southern Syria. On to a conversation about the economy, the global economy, with Chris Riegel. The factory floor in China is troubled, deeply troubled. Unemployment and lack of orders. Christmas season is said to be extremely unlikely this year to be happy. But that was some time ago for China. They're working on the spring collections, and there's no indication that it's going to be stronger than the Christmas collections. A lot of return televisions, a lot of shelves filled with electronics that didn't sell and clothes that didn't move. On to the question of the threat, always the threat, to Israel and to the Israeli effort to bring peace through the Abraham Accords. Hamas is the threat, but Hamas works with Hezbollah and Iran. Iran is the driver of this, and the U.S. policy towards Iran has been contradictory these last years and not likely to get better. Malcolm Hohnlein commented at length about the information space and how at the UN, in Qatar, on television, Israel is not understood as a victim but as a victimizer, oddly. And also, bad information is passed around routinely by major media. For example, the fuel that's in Gaza is said to be a fuel shortage for the million or more people who are camped out in South Gaza. There's no fuel shortage in Gaza. There are 500,000 liters or gallons. There's a lot in storage, but the Hamas will not give it out. They want people to complain that they don't have fuel for their fires and their electricity. Hamas is a torturer of its own people, in addition to the Israelis who were murdered by Hamas. Then a question of what is the ground offensive going to look like? Michael Knights of the Washington Institute comments that the Israelis have been advised to slow it down, not to go in big, but to go in phases, in a working plan that has elements. Now probe. A raid last night might be an example of what's ahead of us. Not to get caught up in urban street fighting, but to have specific targets in mind. Later on, a discussion about nuclear weapons with John Bolton. There's a recommendation from a bipartisan commission that America's arsenal, nuclear weapons arsenal, needs upgrading, reorganization, and also to take on the task that doesn't have a solution of a three-sided war. Two peer adversaries have nuclear weapons aimed at the United States and its allies. The U.S. is responsible to protect not only its own sovereign territory, but that of its allies in Asia and in Europe. A challenge that no one has solved, but there it is. Comrade Black joins to comment on a separatist in Quebec looking to, in some way, penalize young people for speaking English in schools and perhaps forbidding people to carry on in English language in Quebec. It's all quite strange, and Conrad admits it, but there it is. The pleasant and beautiful Canada divided by language. All these decades, all these centuries. My memory of Quebec City is that it's a beautiful place and everybody who spoke French and was very polite, and I don't speak any French and had no difficulty. And they were generous to my visit some years ago. I imagine that's the experience of everyone going to Quebec. Odd separatism. Eurasia. Eurasia has a vision of a trans-Caspian trade infrastructure, and Svante Cornell of the Central Asia Caucasus Institute helps me understand how that plan is being reawakened now. Following the wars, however, it's a struggle. The wars in Europe and the wars in the Middle East. But there is a vision for the 21st century to be able to take goods from China all the way to Europe, across Central Asia, and creating consumers on the way. Later on, a conversation about the disappointment of our elite universities practicing what appears to be anti-Semitism, what is often anti-Semitism, what is clearly anti-Semitism. We're divided into categories. There are shadows here. But in any event, the elite universities have suddenly discovered freedom of speech, yes. But where were they on freedom of speech when it came to virtue signaling or the cancel culture? It is odd. It'll work itself out. But the universities these years have moved to one side of the equation, and there does not seem to be any balance or conversation inside the campus. I had a lovely conversation with Simon Constable in the south of France. He lives in paradise. We talked about how Marie Le Pen, the challenger to the established order, and Emmanuel Macron, the president, twice elected, both have the same opinion on Israel. They stand by it. A coming together of the two parts of French politics. And then Michael Bernstam of the Hoover Institution commenting on the war economy in Russia. What can go wrong and why? That would be inflation. Needs to hide from the public. Finally, artificial intelligence at the Veterans Administration, Veterans Affairs, wonderful. Data points for the vets to understand what they need and what they will need into the future. It's new. It's challenging. Everybody doesn't trust it. But the federal government is learning to be up to date with AI. They did standalone computers. Then they did the cloud. Now they're ready for AI. Robots next. Anyway, there's much more to the show. I hope you enjoy it. I'm John Batchelor.